us safe is connection. Connection first to ourselves, connection with other intimate people in our family, deep friendships, secondary connections, political connections of a group, even if it's just the PTA, a sense of your own agency as part of a group, and connection to the world, that I'm a world citizen. And without those connections, people are utterly lost. Johann Hari has it.
And welcome to a special episode of Club Manifesto. My name is Joe, and of course, I'm joined, as always, by Sos. And today we have a particularly special guest on the podcast. If you are a regular listener to Club Manifesto, you know that in each episode, Sos and I typically choose a manifesto. We talk about who wrote it. We try to sort out what they were trying to say. And you know, sometimes we have guests who come on to try to help us sort through all of that. But today, for the first time, we are joined by someone who actually wrote a manifesto. In this case, one of the authors of Manifesto for a Left Turn, an open letter to U.S. radicals. And again, if you are a regular listener, you'll recognize that title as the manifesto that Sos and I discussed on our most recent episode of the podcast. That document posited that the 40-year decline of an organized and socially influential left must be reversed. It was published in 2008. Sos and I were both very enthusiastic about that document and about its stated goals. And as we expressed in the last episode, we are both also personally fans of this writer's work more broadly. I'm talking, of course, about Dr. Harriet Fraud. Dr. Fraud is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist. She was a founding member of the journal Rethinking Marxism. She's been the author of many articles, mostly about topics in which psychology and economics overlap. Dr. Fraud was also a founding mother of the Women's Liberation Movement in New Haven, Connecticut, and a founding member of the feminist movement in the 1960s. She's also, as far as media goes, the host of her own podcast, Capitalism Hits Home with Dr. Harriet Fraud. And she's a co-host of a podcast called It's Not Just In Your Head with Liam Tate and Ikoi Hiro. And Dr. Fraud also hosts a program on a community radio station, WBAI, at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday nights called Interpersonal Update. Dr. Fraud, thank you so much for joining us on Club Manifesto.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Fraud, as Joe stated, both he and I are fans of your work, and this manifesto, when we read it for the show, it feels, even though it was published in 2008, it feels very contemporary. And since you're the first manifesto author we've had on the podcast, we'd like to ask you some questions about the process of composing a manifesto.
Good.
As we discussed in the last episode, this manifesto addresses a problem and the need for a radical project to advance a leftist movement. And then you decided to participate in the writing and publication of this manifesto. There are so many ways to spread one's message. A manifesto is a difficult document to disseminate to a large audience, especially because it tends to be relatively long. And of course, Manifesto for a Left Turn is a 65-page document. Why did you choose this form as opposed to other forms of media to disseminate your message?
Well, We're all people who are older, and therefore the written word is somehow more compelling to us than being only on social media. And also we wanted something out there that people could see and look over and hopefully get sparked by, you know, hopefully. It didn't quite work out that way because America wasn't ready I think it's readier now, but it wasn't ready. But we wanted something to unite the left rather than having disparate protest movements that have no positive vision and no central core. We saw it as a kind of umbrella where the core, the post of the umbrella, is socialism, economic justice, and then the spokes of the umbrella are things like the climate activism movement, Black Lives Matter, the feminist movement, the sexual liberation movement, the movement for Asian rights, all of the movements that are current that are fighting against injustice. And we wanted to recognize the centrality of class because that is the most repressed discourse in the United States. Race, gender, and sexuality are in the minds of Americans and in the press. Class is obliterated, and it has been since the anti-communist upsurge and manipulation at the end of World War II.
You know, as we were talking about, we talked about this on the last episode, it's clearly a very broad vision in this manifesto. And so, and you've just described obviously a lot of different efforts that might be sort of associated with the movement envisioned in the manifesto. Did you have, I don't know if you can recall, but did you have a specific kind of audience in mind for this manifesto? People who you hoped would read it?
We did. Since it's written, we hope to, that although our language was not trying to obfuscate and make it difficult and just show we're smart by using words people don't understand, we hope to reach people who are reading and looking for some way to make basic system change here. Not just leader change, not just focusing on one of the many disparate issues around which people are upset, but to see the centrality of class, which has been so repressed in the United States. And so that's we were trying to reach anyone who could read.
At this point, did you have a plan for how to publish it, I guess? Was there, how did you plan to distribute it?
We planned to publish it ourselves and advertise it through all the connections that all of us had, because everyone there has had experience on the left. When you said broad-based document, I was thinking I was the only broad on the committee, but I know you didn't mean it that way.
Was it actually published in paper form?
Yes, it was. It was published as a kind of pamphlet, and it was distributed to all sorts of groups, to which each of us was involved. And it didn't do what we wanted, but we did disseminate it. Sometimes if something catches on, if the moment is historically right, things are gobbled up. So the original statements of the adult children of alcoholics and dysfunctional families, and it was ACOA and its offshoot, just spread like wildfire because people were ready for that message. We hoped they were ready for our message, but apparently they weren't.
That's kind of a nice lead into our next question. Since the publication of the manifesto, what kind of response have you or the other authors received about this manifesto?
Well, various of us got invitations to various talks, podcasts, and so on. But the kind of spark which we hoped would light a fire, the spark didn't work. It's because America wasn't ready. I think as the empire crumbles and people's lives crumble with it, they may be more ready, but they're much more primed to look at the bad choices they made individually as part of our ideology in the United States, as blaming the individual or attributing their problems to race or gender or sexual choice than to a systemic oppression here that uses divisions between people to divide a working class that could turn against it, as people were after World War II, during a little before and after World War II, and the same thing that happened after World War I. Because I think what happened after both those world wars is the United States began building an empire. And to disguise that, there was huge propaganda that differentiated democracy, rather than calling it capitalism, they called it democracy, from authoritarian evil communism. And in both cases, those huge socialist movements and left movements of all sorts were vilified as irrelevant, as aiding whatever enemy we had in mind, first Hitler, first fascism, then Russia, and evil communism versus democracy rather than capitalism versus one form of something that called itself communist. And so Americans are confused about that because of the barrage of propaganda, and therefore suspicious of the left as they have not been of the right, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's funny how that rhetoric persists. There's still politicians on both sides talking about fighting communism. And, you know, in the Soviet Union, it made, I guess, some sense because there were no economic ties between America and the Soviet Union. But China is sort of the country in America's crosshairs now, rhetorically. But economically, the two are so intertwined. I don't know if that rhetoric is having the same effect, but it's still. I mean, that's the only line they have, apparently.
Yes, it is, and I think in order to justify continuing wild expenditures, $857 billion on defense, even though it's really offense, nobody's invaded us since 1941, Pearl Harbor, and that was a one-shot invasion, and we have invaded Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and funded movements to unseat many other governments. But somehow Americans are inured to spending their money on war and defense, like now, you know, billions on Ukraine, which they say is for freedom, even though labor unions are banned in Ukraine. All political opposition parties are banned in Ukraine. So it's hardly democracy. But we always need an evil enemy. They had to change after World War II. They had some work to do because Russia and the Soviet Union was our biggest ally in World War II. They lost 30 million people and were at least as important as we were, if not more, in defeating the fascists. And they referred on the radio to Joseph Stalin as Uncle Joe. He was our ally. And the communist movement was doing well. And FDR hired a lot of communists and socialists to craft the New Deal. And the New Deal was not just because FDR was a sweet guy. He ran on a balanced budget and won. But it was because the communist and socialist movements were so powerful and the left was so powerful. In New York, there's a building on 17th Street that was all filled with Communist Party activities, a whole big building. There were marches of the unemployed. Rather than people begging, which are all over New York City, there were marches demanding jobs. And so that FDR could, you know, go to his cronies in the top echelons and say, look, we're stopping a revolution with this New Deal. And give me permission to tax you 94% at the highest bracket. 94%. And so that I can craft these programs to quiet things down. And so they agreed because they were threatened by a left movement. They're not threatened now. And now the top CEOs get not 40%, which they use more than their workers, which they used to, but they get 400 times more. And I think the American people were basically neutralized in the mid-70s to late 70s when their jobs were outsourced overseas, where the capitalists deserted them and they could get cheap labor in India, in China, in Bangladesh, etc. And then brought back their money to buy an electoral system that allowed private money in elections. And people felt that their votes didn't count because basically they didn't count much and just got fat and watched TV and gave up. It's only recently that the labor movement is reigniting, because they kicked the leftists out of the labor movement and the anti-communists repression. And they were the spark. The left was the spark of the union movement. So that spark was stifled. And it's only now that it's coming back. And I don't think they can pull the same kind of anti-communism as a way of shutting up the left that they used to. But we haven't had a continuous left the way they have, let's say, in Europe. You know, it was the Communist Party that was the key factor in the resistance. So talking about them as terribly evil wasn't going to work out very well. In order to get the Marshall Plan money that the United States gave to rebuild their economies, and all the other economies were smashed after World War II, they made it clear that there were to be no communists in the university. So they expunged the university of communism. However, communists and socialists therefore went into the unions, which are some of the most powerful unions in the world. They're the reason 4 million people, a little over 4 million, have been in the streets of France fighting against Macron's bill to reduce the retirement age from 62 to 64. They are mobilized. And that was, you know, it was a consequence of American repression that they have such a labor movement in which no official in the labor movement is allowed to earn more than the highest paid worker. So they don't have a bureaucratic class that doesn't share the same economic reality as their members, and which are organized along political lines, like the communist labor unions, the socialist labor unions, the capitalist labor unions. So it's, and also they don't allow, because they have such a strong presence, they don't allow private money in elections. So they don't get the best democracy money can buy the way we have. So they're ahead that way. And the U.S. is behind.
And so, you know, the U.S. is behind. In 2008, when you were helping to write this manifesto, do you think you sensed at that time that there was maybe some sort of tipping point approaching, some point at which this like left turn that's called for would start to happen?
Yeah, we did. We thought that with the big recession of 2000 and then 2008, people would see, whoa, capitalism is highly unstable. Every 8 to 10 years, people are thrown out of their jobs and their homes. We've got to stop this. We need a stable system with its eye on the mass of people. People weren't ready, and so they didn't galvanize because of the message, but we had hoped that the 2008 crash would wake people up.
Yeah, and speaking of the past, what were some of the events in your own life that brought you to leftism and leftist politics? How did you discover leftism in your own experiences?
Well, in my experience as a very little girl, my dad was in the Communist Party. He left, he said, out of boredom later, but he was in the Communist Party. And they used to have what they called hootenannies, concerts of blacklisted musicians and people who were on the left would go. And so we heard Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, blues artists, Paul Robeson sang. It was an amazing experience. And I, as a little girl, sensed the collegiality, the kindness, the spontaneity, the music, and it made a huge impression on me. Plus my father, who didn't relate to us very much, the little he related was around political beliefs. So when I was in grade school and it was the McCarthy era and they were talking about the bad communists going to jail, he said, those people are our red badge of courage. They stand up for everyone. And that was something I remember. And he also always gave us books. Marzani and Munsell were radical publishers. And so we got books about, you know, Harriet Tubman and about the struggle for freedom, how man became a giant, and through cooperation with each other, since we're not the strongest animals. And those things also built my awareness. And so I remember when I was in grade school as a young teenager, the Rosenbergs were killed. And me and my sister really clung together because we were the only kids in school who thought that was terrible. And we learned we better be quiet. And we were afraid that the FBI would come to our house. And so we devised little protections, which were child protections. You know, we hung tampons on the bushes thinking that'll scare them. I don't know why. But those were formative experiences, and that spirit and that joy and that singing really made a lasting impression on my older sister, Raz Baxendall, and on me. My younger sister wasn't a radical and wasn't part of that.
Was there something, you know, what really has drawn me to your work over the years has been the fact that you do discuss the way in which psychology overlaps with a lot of these leftist topics. Was there some point at which you became interested in sort of psychological issues? Do you have any explanation for why you came to want to focus on that?
Well, I think I did that because, you know, like most therapists, their most frequent Freudian slip is when they want to say my clients, they say my parents, because I think I came from a bourgeois family. What they needed was therapy. You know, the relationships were sad and empty, even though we had a reasonable home and good food. And so that combined with the experience of my father's leftism and what it brought to us made me look to the left. I remember the first book that got me excited as a little girl, I guess I was about 10, was I was trying to read Engels, The Family, Private Property, and the State, because I knew my family really was in trouble. And I didn't quite get what he meant, but I knew there was something very important there. And I think the combination of the leftism I experienced as a joyful, cohesive experience and the dysfunction of my family wanted to bring them together. And yet, even though I was active starting in high school, I was among people who didn't really integrate psychology into their organizing and their platform, which I thought was a big mistake. You know, in high school, I just was into a left group for the rebellion. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a group called the Zealots, which was the leader was Mark Schleifer, who identified as Jewish at the time, but then was one of the founders of Al Jazeera and changed his name. But we picketed temples, Jewish temples, saying, get the moneylenders out of your temple. Like Abe Leibowitz has 6 units on St. Nicholas Avenue in Harlem. Rats, roaches, get them out of your temple. You know, that was just fun to give the finger to those people. Mm-hmm. And so it was a, you know, rebellious fun. but it was the first group I got involved with.
Yeah, I'd certainly identify with the tendency to want to rebel and to get involved with politics for that reason. I think a question I've had for you about psychology is whether you, you focus, if I understand correctly, sort of on the way that a lot of these phenomena affect individual people. And yet, in a way, what we're kind of talking about is, in the manifesto, I think, is a need for a kind of collective struggle. Is there any tension there? Do you sense any tension between your work and the need for a kind of collective uprising?
No, because I think that mental health is built on connection. And the more people are disconnected, the less they're capable of being sane, and also the less they're capable of making change. I notice in my little study of mass murder, now there's two mass murders every day in the United States, and I notice, A, that they're all men who are the most emotionally estranged people, because that's part of the male gender role, not to be in touch with your feelings, particularly of vulnerability and hurt. And they're also, they always say he was a loner. Because what keeps us safe is connection. Connection first to ourselves, connection with other intimate people in our family, deep friendships, secondary connections, political connections of a group, even if it's just a PTA, a sense of your own agency as part of a group, and connection to the world, that I'm a world citizen. And without those connections, people are utterly lost. Johann Hari has a good book about that called Lost Connections. He's not explicitly political and therefore has bestsellers, but that's the point. And I think I saw the disconnection in my own parents and in the dishonesty of pretending that everything's okay as a way of coping, which was a massive way of coping with personal problems at the time and still is, denial. And it's also a massive way of coping with political problems, like the United States' empire is collapsing. And they're handling it by denial. The MAGA people are handling it by asserting we're the greatest while we're not. And China is becoming the greatest, and we're not. And the dollar is being deserted as a currency. The BRICS agreement is growing, and NATO is not as much. And the dollar is being abandoned as a international currency. That there are a lot of signs that our hegemonic hold on the world is weakening. It was China who brokered the deal of peace between Iran and Saudi Arabia and having their embassies with each other, which is partly why the United States condemned China's attempt to make peace between Ukraine and Russia. They don't want the Chinese in that role, but they are.
It's kind of incredible to see a country as big and as powerful as the United States kind of saw off the branch that it's standing on. It's contributing so much to its own decline. The U.S. certainly at the moment has the resources and the capability to change course. And yet, at least in my eyes, it seems that it's the U.S. itself that's tearing itself down from the inside, not these other countries. It's always pointing to other countries as sort of the enemies of the U.S., but therein comes the denial that you talked about, the denial of the self-destruction of in America. And the issues that you're talking about individually, these especially men going on a destructive sort of warpath with these mass killings, it's sort of a microcosm of what the U.S. is doing collectively at a slower pace.
Yeah.
So I want to pivot now to some of the things that manifesto said and called for. So the quintessential leftist manifesto is the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a revolution. The Communist Manifesto was written at a time when the authors believed that capitalism was ascendant and strong. But from our reading of a manifesto for a left turn, your group was calling for something other than the revolution that Marx and Engels were calling for. Is that because you believe capitalism is on the brink of collapse and no revolution is needed? It was a different kind of leftist call than the Communist Manifesto. And I was wondering if you could speak about that a little bit.
Well, Marx was writing as Europe was organizing powerful socialist and communist movements. That isn't happening in the United States. We're at a point where you need a left. And I think fascism came in because capitalists and the big industries of Germany subsidized Hitler because when capitalism falls apart, fascism comes in to hold it together with an authoritarian government. And I think you can see that in the United States now. It's not united. There's two forces. One is neoliberalism, like Biden, and the other is fascism, like Trump. And the left has to be there, and it isn't. And I think a first step is to create a left. And that's why we don't have what Marx did, which is a growing communist force in Europe. And in Russia, beginning as well. You know, there was an uprising against the Tsar in Russia in 1905. But, you know, we were at a much earlier phase of development where we need an opposition that's out there so people can find a place for their personal anger and privation outside of taking power through a gun, even though the gun manufacturers have pushed that. You know, I don't know if you're aware of the Bushmaster Automatics successful ad, which they've had to take down, which was, and the NRA, which is the lobbying group for the arms sellers in the United States, they push macho propaganda. And an ad for the Bushmaster was, "Does your wife or girlfriend make more money than you? Revoke your man card. Do you prefer tofu to meat? Revoke your man card." And then there was five other things. And then it said, "Reinstate your man card, Bushmaster, automatic weapon." That you can regain your power to protect yourself through a gun. And that ad was pulled because people were so outraged. But it was a very successful ad. And what it does is focus men's anger on women, like the incel movement does, as being inadequately subservient and sexually available, and on minorities, and gives you the power through your gun to protect yourself from change. And what we wanted to do was give people a movement to protect themselves from being economically and socially ravaged by capitalism.
Yeah, and in doing so, the manifesto is advocating for what it calls a radical project. And one of the goals of that project is to, quote, "take seriously the achievements of psychoanalysis in both problems of individual pathologies and social pathologies, and discover ways of integrating these with the radical project," unquote. And so I have a sense you were kind of just talking about that in a way with the that advertisement, or at least trying to understand the pathologies related to that advertisement. But I mean, what do you see as the achievements of psychoanalysis that could be used in a leftist movement? What would it mean to take those seriously in that context?
Well, I think the biggest, most important discovery, well, it wasn't discovered, but development of psychoanalysis was the discovery of the unconscious. And that every for everything that happens, there's a set of unconscious meanings as well as conscious meanings. And I think that the way political movements operate is not just through an compelling intellectual analysis, which is important, but through capturing the upset, the suffering, the rage of people. And so I think that the left tends to think that intellectual explanations, particularly of how you've been oppressed, are the way to galvanize people. I think people don't want to be told they're suckers and they're losers and this is why, and they're oppressed. I think they want to be told that they can be powerful and that they're important and that their psychological connection and emotional connections with other people are important and with themselves are important. And those things are not part of a lot of left discourse, which usually points out to people that they're victimized. A lot of people don't want to identify as victims, and they're quite right. And when they do identify as victims, they usually identify whoever is around them as victimizing them. So the early women's movement felt victimized by men, and then Gloria Steinem's CIA influence influenced them to be a gender-only movement, excising class. And the civil rights movement morphed into the Black Power movement against Whitey, subsidized also by the CIA and the FBI in their great operation, the Great Wurlitzer, I think, because that was an organ that changed people's, that changed tone. That I think we have to see the importance of connection and that we are part of a majority that can't win unless we're together, because they have the money. We have the power of the people. And I think that psychological element of need for one another and unity has been much too missing as we keep discovering new victimizations of ourselves. One of the things the right wing does is you're not a victim, you're powerful.
You know, I've heard you talk about Gloria Steinem's effect on the women's movement quite a bit. And I guess I'm curious how much, you know, we're talking about the ways in which the left has kind of failed to really materialize in the United States over the last several decades. How much of that do you attribute to efforts by the government and, you know, in Gloria Steinem's case, the CIA?
Yeah, a lot. I think there were huge efforts because, and there still are, the effort to transform class politics into identity politics, which divides the working class against each other. And, you know, we were naive. We thought it was great Gloria Steinem got us Ms. Magazine with no ads. We didn't say, uh-oh, where's the money coming from? We were just excited to have this new vehicle. And I think we didn't appreciate the level of interference of the government in the left. You know, we didn't appreciate that. We knew the government interference in the Panther Party because we were in New Haven. We saw what they were doing and how many spies there were and the divisive and sort of masculinist, militaristic influence that those people peddled. We also noticed at the rallies, we would stand next to some of the people who were infiltrators in the Panther Party. And instead of shouting Chairman Mao, they'd say Sherman Mao and Arthur Pig instead of Off the Pig. They had no idea what they were doing, except that they were there to disrupt and to divide. And it ended up that they tortured and murdered somebody who they suspected of being an informant. And that was, and they got the armaments from somebody who was, we told them, was a police informant. He was a junkie who the police allowed to function and not jail because he wanted to pin pills on people and he joined radical movements and narked people out. We knew that. We knew he was selling bullets to the Panthers and they wouldn't listen to us and thought of us as old fuddy-duddies because we weren't into this militaristic approach. So we were aware of it in that particular case, but we didn't see the breadth and depth of their invasion.
Yeah, and it, I mean, more recently, there has been some publicized interference with, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement. There's actually a podcast that just came out not too long ago called Alphabet Boys that details the way in which the FBI was effectively planting pretty pernicious informants within the movement in within the BLM movement in Denver specifically. But of course, just as you didn't know the breadth of what was going on back then, we have no real way of knowing precisely how deep that goes now.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, even like with the Black Panthers, one of their highest ranking members, Richard Aoki, it's been revealed that he too was a government agent. The the infiltrations go so deep. And what are some of the blind spots, Dr. Fraud, do you think that the left has now that they're not aware of, as opposed to the left in the 1960s?
Well, I think that now people are blinded by the divisiveness of identity politics. And so they can spend a meeting monitoring each other's microaggressions and worrying about pronouns instead of looking at what's happening to the mass of people and what can we do about it together. And so that they get bogged down through the minutiae of identity politics. And that really is something that the mass of people can't identify with and is boring, and you know, people leave. And it's not a unifying class politics at all. That's how they get bogged down.
Well, Dr. Fraud, you've been very generous with your time this morning, and we don't want to take up your entire Saturday. But as far as a sort of final question here, you know, clearly you're involved in a lot of work related to disseminating information about what I think is fair to call, left efforts. Do you think that there are people now doing work that is helping fulfill the vision of the left movement described in the manifesto?
Yes. You know, I see the co-op movement is burgeoning, which is creating an alternative economy. There are whole areas like Jackson, Mississippi, where the Jackson, Mississippi cooperative is very powerful, showing an alternative. There's also one in Northern California whose name will come back to me, that has taken over a whole area and united with a Native American group. And there are people all over who are understanding that without a class unifier, we'll never win. There aren't enough of them. We're not in enough leadership positions, but they're there because the failure of the left to stem the immiseration of the American people and the withdrawal, the steady withdrawal of the New Deal protections and the bizarre corruption. It's not the United States anymore. It's not united at all. But, you know, it was really well illustrated. It's well illustrated by Santos, who every other week there's another criminal revelation of him. And in the comedian Chelsea Handler has a wonderful bit where she said this time the inauguration wasn't boring. You know, Biden's speech wasn't so boring because Marjorie Taylor screamed, liar, and George Santos said, over here, right over here. That there is this recognition that the whole thing is fake and has nothing to do with people's needs, which I think is omnipresent. What people are going to do about it has to be changed. People have to be galvanized, and they really are. But the realization is much sharper than it was in 2008 when we wrote that manifesto.
So, Dr. Farad, we mentioned some of the podcasts that you're involved in at the top of the show. If people are more interested in your work and what you have to say, where are some other places they can find you? And is there anything you'd like to plug on the show?
Yeah, at Democracy at Work is a good place. They have lots of podcasts. They can, you know, there are so many voices on the left these days. They can go to your podcast. They can look for left podcasts and find them. It's really, you know, there's a thirst for knowledge. Rick Wolf's Economic Update is enormously popular. When he walks down the street, people recognize him all over the place. Even in California, they recognize him all over, because people are hungry to understand, like, this latest crisis, supply chains. That's crazy. Any supplier understands that there could be glitches in what to do. And it's just capitalist greed. And when he exposes it, people are relieved, because it's an explanation that makes sense. Otherwise, they feel completely lost, because it's lies. And the liars are in the top of the government. They're abandoned in terms of leadership. So, you know, there's a huge number of left outlets. I mean, there are loads of popular podcasts that expose this.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, Dr. Farad, thank you, you know, first for contributing to the manifesto, which, like we said before, I think we both found to be really important, and I think has produced a good discussion here today. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this morning.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad I came.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Why do we keep drifting apart? You know that you're to blame. Why do you keep breaking my heart? Our love is not a game. You made a promise that you'd always be mine. When you broke that promise, the sun refused to shine. So why do we keep drifting apart?